the life and soul of the party, the Communist Party that is, and the afterlife and other occultism in Russia. Believe it or not, they are connected. Hello, I'm Mark Galliotti, and welcome to my view of Russia in Moscow's shadows. This podcast, of varying length, frequency, and format, yet always reassuringly low production values, is supported by generous and perspicacious patrons, who also receive extra perks and bonuses appropriate to their tier. If you'd like to join them, just head on to patreon.com/inmoscowshadows. But now, on with today's programme. I wrote a commentary this week for the Moscow Times on the way that, having long relied on it as a stalwart of the so-called systemic opposition, the Kremlin now seems to be treating the Communist Party, the KPRF, KPRF, as if it were a real opposition party after all. And also I contemplated whether or not this might prove to be a self-fulfilling prophecy. So what I want to do in the first half of this episode is to, in a way, go over my discussion, but in a wider and deeper way, and then have, frankly, a bit of fun in the second half. For the past two decades, the KPRF has been a fixture of the theatrical fake politics that the Kremlin has used, frankly, very effectively, to generate a kind of hybrid regime, at once authoritarian and yet not totally undemocratic. If the ultranationalist liberal democrats were there essentially to be a haven for those who wanted to make a protest against United Russia without really voting for anyone else, well, the KPRF was there to soak up both the genuine leftists and also the Soviet nostalgics, without, of course, it meaning anything. They were there to shout and to complain, to wave red banners and march beneath portraits of Stalin, yet never actually challenge the government when it really, really mattered. Indeed, like Vladimir Zhirinovsky's Liberal Democrats, in many ways, the role of the communists was also to be so unattractive and indeed unelectable that the Kremlin's party of power, United Russia, might, just about might, even look appealing in comparison. The party's official goal, by the way, is for Russia to become, quote, a strong, just, socialist homeland. However, given that communist leader Gennady Zyuganov has taken to calling for socialism in the image of China, well, in the image of an exploitative, techno-authoritarian regime with growing inequalities in wealth and opportunity, well, then really one could wonder just how leftist, let alone communist, the KPRF really is, or at least Zyuganov really is. I mean, look, the platform for the September elections that the Communist Party has just recently put out, it talks of nationalising strategic sectors of the economy and, of course, systemically important banks, about raising the minimum wage, about phasing out VAT, about installing price controls. Nothing on, well, first of all, nothing on actually how they would pay for all of this, but also nothing on making the political system more accountable, more transparent, let alone the kind of grassroots reforms that even many within the party are calling for. And this, in many ways, shouldn't really surprise us. Zyuganov has, it's worth remembering, led the party since, and this still amazes me, 1993. Previously, as a relatively young communist apparatchik in the 1980s, he criticised Mikhail Gorbachev's perestroika reforms as being too liberal. And then later on, in 2010, he called for the re-Stalinization of Russia. Bless. That said, I mean, since the 1996 presidential elections, which were probably stolen from them, but anyway, since then, the KPRF has never looked in danger of actually winning anything. And from a high of about 24% of the vote in 1999, its share of certainly parliamentary elections outcomes have been sort of somewhere between 11 and 19%. Now, though, we see this general shift towards a much, much more serious authoritarianism mode of political control. And as the Kremlin increasingly abandons attempts to sort of cosplay democracy and instead relies more on the direct suppression of any critical voices, the campaign seems to have moved from exclusively focusing on Team Navalny and other members of the non-systemic opposition and is now beginning to hit also the KPRF. The most striking example of this was when Pavel Grudinin, the agribiz millionaire and CEO of the Lenin farm, who ran against Putin in the 2018 presidential elections. Well, he was meant to be third on the Communist Party ticket for the September elections after Zyuganov and cosmonaut Svetlana Savitskaya. But anyway, he has been barred by the Central Election Commission. And the grounds are that he's in breach of the rules against candidates owning property abroad. But even that, I mean, it's because he is meant to still have shares in a Belize-based company called Bontro. On the other hand, he claims that he unloaded his shares in 2017. And in any case, frankly, the firm itself closed in 2019. So look, this looks as ever as if they were just simply casting around for suitable grounds to exclude him. Now, Zyuganov was visibly furious about that. He called it a sign of the fascistification of the country, characterized by, let's have a nice quote here, forceful reprisals against the opposition, dirty raiding of people's enterprises, fake pensions, cannibalistic reforms, wild extortions, innumerable taxes. And as a result, the Communist Party has applied for permits to hold protest rallies on the, basically the middle of August and the 1st of September. And there are warnings from senior party figures that even if these are not authorised, that the Communists will still take to the streets. Now, this is all very exciting stuff on one level and raises the question, does it mean that Zyuganov, after more than two decades of civility, has finally grown a backbone? Well, possibly, but as you'll soon discover, I'm not entirely convinced. Look, the implicit deal, after all, was that he would ensure that the Communist Party played its role in the whole Kremlin dramaturgia, all this kind of fake theatricality of politics, in return for respect and status. And part of, if not the main part, of Zyuganov's fury is not necessarily because of the unfair treatment meted out to Grudinin, but actually because this reflects badly on him. And this makes it clear that the new team of presidential administration political technologists under Sergei Kiryenko look as if they decided to kind of reshuffle the political deck and therefore feel no need to pander to the aging communist leader. And in some ways, it's amour propre as much as anything else that seems to be driving him. On the other hand, one could also present a rather more cynical, pragmatic and transactional take. And that is that as Zyuganov sees that United Russia is floundering, I mean, it's currently struggling to get much more than 25% in opinion polls. And yet the Kremlin is still clearly hoping to be able to engineer a supermajority in the Duma. Well, Zyuganov is instead causing some trouble to raise his price. The more the Communist Party is a headache for the presidential administration, then the more concessions he can extract. Because after all, at the moment, the Communists are polling around 10%. Again, not in any way a serious challenge to the Kremlin, but enough in theory to deny them that supermajority, certainly if the vote is anything vaguely fair in count. So, you know, it could well be that his point is that he's willing to play the role of the angry oppositionist if it'll buy him a better payoff. If that is his calculation, though, I suspect he's made a mistake. This is not an age of politics as usual, and today's Kremlin looks much, much more inclined to bear down and bulldoze over inconveniences rather than to buy them off. And I reckon that they feel that Zyuganov himself, frankly, is pretty much past his sell-by date. But in any case, look, Zyuganov doesn't actually have much choice. He has to push back. Because on the one hand, the KPRF faces marginalisation. if it allows the presidential administration to have its way, it may well shrink into insignificance. And on the other, Zyuganov is facing pressure from below, from a younger generation of communists who actually believe, strangely enough, that the business of an opposition is to oppose. Some of these, it's worth noting, do still retain links to Navalny's people. I mean, they certainly hope to benefit from his smart voting campaign to encourage tactical voting against United Russia. And as I said in a previous podcast, as usual, I'll leave a link in the programme notes, I see the Communist Party as really being made up of three components. There are the opportunists, people like, frankly, Zyuganov, who simply regard being a member of the Communist Party and playing their role within the theatrical politics as being their route to a nice life. It's an easy sinecure. And frankly, it's not just Zyuganov. I think most of the rest of the national and indeed local leaderships fall into this category. Secondly, we have the veterans, the Stalinist grannies, the Soviet nostalgics, the ones for whom this is in some ways, although they actually support much of what Putin does, especially on the international stage, it is about harkening back to a Soviet Union, frankly, that never really was. This is, I mean, if I can be sort of trivialising it, this is the Brighton Beach school of Communist Party politics. And then there's the younger generation, who, on the whole, I would say are not often really communists at all, certainly not in the good old-fashioned Marxist-Leninist variety. Really, they're reformists, they're liberals, who want to have some kind of a change in the system. But they were too timid to join Navalny, and probably congratulating themselves for their percipience about that, and for whom the Communist Party was a safer haven. If you want to have the familiarity, that sense of a party structure into which you fit, the communists do sort of meet that need. Now, despite the move against Grudinin, who, frankly, I don't really see as a leftist firebrand, you know, I can't help but wonder if the real targets are actually going to be in this last category. The young generation who still have some degree of hope or of optimism or of belief that things can change. For example, there's the Saratov region Communist Party deputy and very popular YouTuber Nikolai Bondarenko, who faces being barred from running on really distinctly iffy allegations of distributing extremist propaganda. Now, it's worth noting, after all, that he had been detained in the past, in February, attending pro-Navalny rallies. So he's in many ways a poster child of that cohort. Savvy, big on social media, communist, and an active communist, also engaged in trying to get sort of real change in his own region, but also still has these connections to more kind of radical types of politics. Potentially more important, though, is in some ways I would suggest the way that Valery Rashkin, head of the Moscow branch of the Communist Party, and one of the up-and-coming next generation of leaders, after all, he is a stripling of just 66. That's positively junior by the standards of Communist Party leadership. Anyway, he is facing a potential corruption investigation in Moscow. Now, if that goes ahead, it'll be a powerful symbol that the forces of the state are coming for the Communist Party in earnest. And also that flirting with Navalny's movement, as Rashkin did, is grounds for political liquidation. Because finally, there are other hints of what we might think of as a generalised campaign to undermine and discredit the communists as a whole. Very familiar tactics, but a distinctly unfamiliar and novel target. More recently, for example, there was one particular case. They found themselves being linked with the so-called Skopinski maniac, who was a very vicious sex offender by the name of Viktor Mokhov. He was released from a strict regime penal colony this spring after serving 16 years for kidnapping two girls, aged 14 and 17, keeping them in the basement of his house for almost 4 years, during which he subjected them to persistent and brutal sexual violence. So, you know, no wonder he became, you know, genuinely nationally infamous. Yet, at the end of July, he crops up in a video being circulated on social media, wearing a Communist Party t-shirt and cap, wholeheartedly supporting Gennady Zyuganov. Now, obviously, the communists leapt forward to say that he has nothing to do with them and calling this a provocation ahead of the elections. And it has to be said, I don't think that's wholly implausible, especially because it later emerged that what had been circulated was an artfully chosen snippet of the full video in which Makhov was actually criticising the communists. But nonetheless, this nice little clip made it look as if he was wholeheartedly behind them. Well, welcome to the serious world of Kremlin black PR, boys and girls of the Communist Party. Now you know what it's like. So, the once docile Communist Party is finding itself in this very unfamiliar position of being treated as an opposition party by the Kremlin. This may, and I really would want to stress, you can consider it to be italicised, underlined and put in bold, however much of a style solecism that is. But anyway, this may give them the opportunity to redefine themselves as a genuine and serious political force, especially if the communists can move beyond their kind of familiar talking points of, you know, higher pensions and reverence for the war veterans and all this, and actually present themselves as a serious party with a serious manifesto that addresses issues of, firstly, corruption, and secondly, representation within the political system. If they could do that, things would be very different. They could actually position themselves as Russia's only real opposition party of the moment. They have the last truly independent national political machine in the country that isn't entirely dependent upon Kremlin subsidies. Their years championing their triumph of the Great Patriotic War and so forth makes them pretty much immune, I would suggest, to the usual charges of being Western stooges. Indeed, if anything, two can play that game. I mean, another one of Zhuganov's broadsides after the exclusion of Grudinin presented the struggle as being between patriotic left-wing forces, i.e. them, and the liberal oligarchic pack that seized our country in 1991, which is clinging to power with claws and teeth. Well, I mean, okay, very much overheated rhetoric, but I would just draw your attention to the fact of presenting the communists as patriotic left-wing forces. Whereas liberal oligarchic pack, I mean, that is very much associated with closeness to the West and seized our power in 1991. Again, it's trying to connect Putin with the 1990s, the era precisely that he has tried to distance himself from and in a way build as part of his own political mandate the fact that he saved Russia from the 1990s. So actually, look, it's not as if the communists do not have some particular, you know, weapons themselves. However, this will take guts, massive amounts of guts, because it really will expose the Communist Party to the full political firepower of the Kremlin, and quite frankly, they have a lot. It's hard to see Zhuganov and the other current magnates of the party, who are accustomed, after all, to a very comfortable life of fake opposition, truly embracing this. But as I said, they are being squeezed that way, both by an increasingly intolerant Kremlin that in some ways isn't letting them stick to their comfortable old ways, and also their own grassroots. It may be significant that at the end of June, the leaders of the Left Front, which is best represented by radical serial detainee Sergei Udaltsov, and the four new socialism movements, joined the Communist Party. And now actually have their own candidates on Communist Party lists for the September elections. Now, both movements have been very, very sharply critical of the Kremlin on essentially domestic political issues. Again, they don't tend to have a problem with the international side of things. But they're also much, much more interested in the systemic questions. They are talking about fundamental questions of power and of the structure, not on who owns the banks, let alone how much VAT to levy on children's textbooks, the way Zhuganov is. People like Udaltsov and Movement for New Socialism's leader Nikolai Platoshkin, they're not angling for comfortable sinecures from the Kremlin. They have demonstrated themselves willing to face arrest and detention, and that, to be blunt, is what it will take. Of course, even if the KPRF now has firebrands, the Kremlin, as I said, still has the firepower. But sometimes it's not enough. Political scientist Gleb Pavlovsky has actually speculated that the Kremlin is going to manage to push the communists out of the Duma altogether. Perhaps the new leftist, frankly, Frankenstein's monster of a block, a Just Russia Patriots for Truth, which has been stitched together from parts of fully 9 smaller factions. Well, maybe this will take the KPRS kind of role in the drama as the leftist protest vote party that is also a safe one from the Kremlin's point of view. I mean, in this respect, they're kind of be the up-and-coming not-yet-star who replaces the fading star. You know, the hungry but less well-known actor who comes in season 2, 3, 5, or 10 of a long-running show that maybe is just getting that little bit tired. But the point is that it's still doing absolutely nothing for the discontent that continues to make people join and vote for the communists and indeed for other opposition parties. That same coalition of the fed up that also fueled Navalny's movement is ultimately going to have to go somewhere. I mean, many of them may well just simply be turned off politics, but not all of them. And the more that they feel that the constitutional system offers them absolutely nothing, well, the more they will be tempted to alternative means, alternative forms of politics. And so actually, it could well be that even if the communists do manage to get rid of the Communist Party, and so actually, it may well be that if the Kremlin does one day manage to get rid of the Communist Party, it will actually end up in due course missing them if they do. So it may well be that actually if the Kremlin does one day succeed in breaking the Communist Party, in moving it out of mainstream politics, it may well miss them too. Just the usual reminder, you're listening to the In Moscow Shadows podcast. You can support it by going to patreon.com/inmoscowshadows. And remember that patrons get a variety of additional perks, as well as knowing that they're supporting this peerless source on all things Russian. And you can also follow me on Twitter, at Mark Galliotti, or on Facebook, Mark Galliotti on Russia. Now, back to the show. What does the Communist Party stand for? Well, if you listen to their slogans, look at their banners, read their website, it's all social justice, reverence for the great patriotic war, red flags, hammers and sickles, the pantheon of Marx, Engels, Lenin, Zhukov and Gagarin, and maybe a bit of Stalin. Of course, there's a nationalistic side to it, and a liberal element too, but there's also more. Because for a party that is supposedly based on a materialist and rationalist creed, there's also quite a bizarre strain of occultism and parapsychology there too. For a start, it's worth noting a depressingly strong anti-vaccination sentiment in the party, which is frankly trying to capitalise on the wider resistance within the Russian public, especially to compulsory vaccinations, which, incidentally and ironically, it championed back in 1998. The aforementioned Rashkin, for example, is reportedly amongst the vaccine sceptics, for example. And that's bad enough. It's obscurantist and it's dangerous. But oh boy, things actually go a long way beyond that. And I don't even just mean those people who believe that Lenin could be revived, or, and this I thought this was wonderful, contacted for guidance by seance. Splendid. Or indeed that Stalin is cloned. You know, and believe me, these people do exist. And they crop up in all kinds of unlikely places. In some cases, I know that from personal experience. But I'm talking about proper, weird, powers beyond our mortal ken types. For example, since 2019, the ranks of the Communist Party of the Russian Federation include the red battle magician and psychic Emma Raiman, a self-proclaimed eso-psychologist, and no, I have no idea what that means either, and TV personality with a sideline in a rejuvenating skincare regime, who previously had for a year been with Yabloko in St. Petersburg, the other sort of rather more liberal opposition party. And then let's talk about the self-proclaimed warrior shaman, Alexander Gabishev, who was forcibly committed to a mental hospital after he set out on the 3,000-mile walk from Yakutsk to Moscow, eventually declaring that he was on a mission to expel Putin from the Kremlin because, of course, Putin is a demonic force, antithetical to nature. Gabishev's aim was to get to Moscow, where he would light a cleansing fire in Red Square, right in front of the Kremlin, feed it with, and this is good Yakut tradition, feed it with kumis, fermented horse milk, and horsehair, and then chant and pray as he beats on his leather tambourine. And then apparently Putin would come to his senses and resign. Okay. Now, Gabishev is not a member of the Communist Party, but certainly the communists were extremely supportive, and that included convening a public gathering for him in Chita when he was on the way and arguing against his sectioning. Now, look, I don't know. Maybe this kind of stuff really will scare Putin. You know, if you can't deselect and unelect him, maybe you can exorcise him. Because the interesting thing is that there is certainly a parallel belief in all kinds of weird parapsychology and religious mysticism amongst his supporters and allies, certainly. And it's, you know, this goes all the way up to Security Council Secretary Nikolai Patrushev, who, you know, apparently is willing sincerely to believe that a Russian psychic read US Secretary of State Madeleine Albright's dreams and from them divined the secret Western plan to fragment the Russian Federation because Russia doesn't deserve to have all the riches of Siberia to itself. Or, indeed, one could point to the way that Orthodox elder Skema Archimandrite Ily Nozdrin, who's confessor to Patriarch Kirill and has hobnobbed with Putin many a time, flew over Moscow last year in a private jet to perform a blessing to protect Russia from coronavirus. Yeah, how's that working out? And of course, we can't forget the continued official interest in the writings of Lev Gumilyov, who thought that nations draw their kind of collective drive, which he called passionarnost, from cosmic rays. So maybe the KPRF is simply holding up a red-tinted mirror to a wider trend in Russian politics where, let's say, hard-nosed opportunism, genuine idealism, and batshit mysticism all collide. All parties and polities have their fringes, of course. But sometimes it does look as if Russian politics is as much fringe as anything else. And look, on this point, look, it's also worth noting, that, and I love this, since 2008, the government has required anyone wanting to advertise their services as magic. And look, I'm not talking about pulling doves out of top hats. But anyway, anyone who wants to call themselves a magic practitioner has needed an official license. Yes, while paranormal services are apparently still fair game, you can just call yourself as a provider of that without any trouble, any self-respecting wizard, witch, sorcerer, or necromancer does need to go through a formal licensing procedure. And I really, really would love to know what that entails, if anyone out there knows and can tell me. But nevertheless, this means that back in 2018, the Russian Academy of Sciences said that there were something like 800,000 faith healers in the country, compared with 640,000 accredited doctors, you know, real doctors. And while I'm just throwing out bits and pieces, I do truly treasure the claim in one paper, one newspaper, that Putin regularly goes on holidays to the distant Altai region, not because he's off hiking with his new mate Sergei Shoigu, who is himself from the Tuva region of the Altai. Oh no, he's actually going there because he is seeking access to the Tibetan Buddhist mystical kingdom of Shambhala, the hidden Shangri-La, where secrets of immortality and mystic transcendence lie. Because that makes so much more sense, surely. But why is there this continued fascination with the arcane? I don't know. I mean, it's always tempting to start talking about folkways and traditions, about mystical notions of kingship and the like. But the danger is that this is a hop, skip, and an incantation away from the kind of questionable stereotyping and historical determinism that gets you arguing that Russians instinctively need an authoritarian patriarchal figure, and that Ivan is never happier than when he's feeling that the touch of the knout. So let's not go there. Rather, I suspect it has something to do with anime and something to do with pattern recognition. it's the way, again, that all politics is at least largely in Russia about performance and not substance, or public politics, shall we say. And if you are pretending to be playing a serious role, but actually know that you are just simply a prop on the stage, that must have a morally corrosive effect. It must create a vacuum in the soul, and vacuums are there to be filled by something. After all, the real boom in occultism took place in parallel with the collapse of the Soviet idea, when you had figures like the hypnotist Kashpirovsky, who promised he could cure you through your TV set. These kind of people truly flourished in that time. And that's where there was this sudden, dramatic hole in, I wouldn't say people's souls, but people's understandings of who they were as a nation, as a people, what they had suffered for. That's the enemy I'm talking about. And in a different way, although obviously now is not the late 1980s, but in a different way, particularly amongst the political class, the public political class, who are meant to be politicians but know they're not, I can't help but feeling this must still be a canker in their soul. And as for pattern recognition, what I mean by that is this very, very human desire to believe that they can see the logics of the world around them and even use them to their own advantage. You know, occultism, after all, rests on a conviction that there are these deeper truths and secret mysteries, and that properly interpreted, the facts of the mundane world will reveal these hidden ones. So, you know, the future can be foretold in the flights of birds. A man's destiny can be revealed in the stars. You know, somehow, if you know the mystic arts, you can see the magical world through what others would regard as the ordinary workings of the mundane world. Now, the awkward admission is that much the same could be said of Kremlinology, where political meaning is divined from the framing of a photo or the order of signatures on a decree. Now, of course, I really wouldn't want to suggest that. Indeed, one could suggest much political science to a degree depends on a determination to impose meaning on what may be irrelevant data. Oh no, I wouldn't say that. But you might. Anyway, what I would say is that on a psychological and epistemological level, there is much that unites occultism and Russian politics. The hidden forces manifesting themselves mysteriously through the open forms of policy, whether it's a Duma vote or a sudden resignation. The urgent quest to penetrate the veil, the belief that if you can crack the code of the hidden realm, if you can understand what's really going on behind those high red walls of the Kremlin, this ability is the route to, if not immortality, at least fortune and prosperity. And as a result of that, this constant attempt to try and come up with the real explanation, that it must be more than how it looks, there has to be some deeper, deeper meaning. And as a result, you can put 10 people together to interpret the same data points, and they will come up with 11 different theories. Of course, maybe it's just only sensible to be an occultist in today's Russia. Maybe that's the point. I mean, I don't mean in the sense of the quest for Shambhala and the powers of parapsychology, but in terms of the fact that if you really want to understand what's going on, you have to take this handful of data points where the secret world intrudes into the visible world and try and understand what's going on. But as I wander into the trackless wastes of national psychology and indeed parapsychology, perhaps it's best if I return to solid ground and bring this episode to an end. Well, that's the end of another episode of the In Moscow Shadow podcast. Just as a reminder, beyond this, you can follow my blog, also called In Moscow Shadows. Follow me on Twitter, at Mark Galliotti, or Facebook, Mark Galliotti on Russia. This podcast is made possible by generous and enlightened patrons, and you too can be one. Just go along to my Patreon page, that's patreon.com/inmoscowshadows, and decide which tier you want to join, getting access to exclusive materials and other perks. However, whether or not you contribute, thank you very much indeed for listening. Until next time, keep well. И только будь, пожалуйста, со мною, товарищ прав.